From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Tuesday night, during the State of the Union address, President Obama recognized one business leader as the symbol of the best America has to offer.
It means we should support everyone who's willing to work, and every risk-taker and entrepreneur who aspires to become the next Steve Jobs.
The fabled Apple co-founder died last October. The TV audience had to settle for a glimpse of his widow. But even death has not prevented Jobs from becoming 2012's It Boy. Walter Isaacson's propitiously timed biography remains on the bestseller lists. On the strength of Christmas sales of the iPad, Apple had a monster fourth quarter and is now the most valuable company in the world. The Apple brand borders on a cult, and the late Jobs has gone from living legend to dead demigod, and on a bipartisan basis. This was Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels with the Republican response to the State of the Union.
The late Steve Jobs, what a fitting name he had, created more of them than all those stimulus dollars the president borrowed and blew.
That bit of apple polishing engendered some cognitive dissonance. The company's record on U.S. jobs is not stellar. In a recent series about Apple, the New York Times reported that almost all iPhones and iPads are built not by Americans, but mainly by Chinese workers in factory cities amid shocking working conditions. And the details of iPad's inhumanity to man were dramatically revealed on an episode of This American Life 3 weeks ago by investigative monologuist Mike Daisy.
I talk to people whose joints in their hands have disintegrated from working on the line, doing the same motion hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times. It's like carpal tunnel on a scale we can scarcely imagine. And you need to know that this is eminently avoidable. If these people were rotated monthly on their jobs, this would not happen. But that would require someone to care.
The Daily Show, too, focused on the labor conditions at that factory, Foxconn, where employees worked insane hours.
The job was to assemble a tiny part of a mobile phone 5,200 times a day.
5,200 times a day? How long's a day?
He's been working for as much as 35 hours continuously.
So a day is a day and a half.
Stephen Levy writes for Wired and is the author of Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the computer that changed everything. He says Apple's reputation will withstand even these latest revelations.
Our relationship with Apple is conveyed mainly by two things. One is there's the Jobs myth, and you could see it by being invoked by both parties last week, but also by the relationship we have with their products. We just love them.
So as long as they continue to deliver magnificent-looking goods that really, really work, nobody much cares about how they go about doing it?
I think the cult you mentioned earlier is going to dismiss these charges and say, look, every company has to deal with it. Look, I'm pretty sure that the people at Apple have sleepless nights over this because they would prefer, I think, for their workers to have very comfortable conditions there, but they're under terrific pressure to deliver their products at low prices. This is pressure from us. We buy more Apple stuff when it's more affordable.
Bad conditions in offshore plants have gotten attention periodically over the last 20 years. It happened to Nike concerning factories in Vietnam, and it's happened to other big brand names. But I wonder if Apple is so much at the center of our sense of technology as savior that the U.S. government will actually be obliged to put the squeeze on China in a way it hasn't before, to see that companies like Foxconn, the contract manufacturer at issue here, begins to conform to better working conditions.
I guess it could happen. It would be a protectionist move that could bite us back in other ways. It's no accident that this stuff is being discussed politically because it's tied to the American problem of losing manufacturing businesses, right? Apple does employ tens of thousands of people, generally in more creative jobs and design jobs. They're building a giant new headquarters in Cupertino. And people say that this is the paradigm that we have now, and it will just continue in the future where the great jobs in America are not manufacturing jobs, but creative jobs.
this guy, Mike Daisy, the monologuist, identified himself as a total Apple geek. And he field strips his Power Mac because it relaxes him. You too are kind of an Apple geek, right? You've been following the company for a couple of decades.
Yep.
And, you know, in the wake of a week like this, are you on balance for them or are you a ginnam?
The questions that I struggle with are we're doing things now that are way beyond the concerns of people around the world that struggle just to eat. And if looking at Apple helps us focus the way we feel about that, or maybe spur us into action, or maybe letting Apple know that we're willing to pay a little more for any company which guarantees better working conditions, then that's a good thing. I know that for many, many years, Apple got a lot of criticism because they weren't price competitive, and a lot of people wouldn't buy the products because of that. So Apple's operating the way capitalism is telling it to do, and it's really up to us to send a signal that Apple's leadership in this area would be appreciated by us.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Levy writes about Apple for Wired and is the author most recently of In the Plex.
Remember the 2010 State of the Union Address? Awkward.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
Viewers could see Justice Samuel Alito grimacing and mouthing the words, "not true." The State of the Union address is perhaps not the best forum for a discourse among branches of the U.S. government, but isn't mere attendance by Supreme Court justices a way of communicating? If not, then why do some justices pointedly opt out? That's precisely the question answered in a new paper of Potted Plants and Political Images, the Supreme Court and the State of the Union Address. Co-author Michael W. Giles says 2010's showdown was uncharacteristic.
Probably a breach of decorum on both sides, both in terms of the pointedness of the president's comments, and certainly at least over the past few decades, the presence of any response to the speech by a member of the Supreme Court.
So what do you make of Justice Scalia's comment that attendance is a juvenile exercise? Isn't that what he said?
Well, I think he more saying that it's an event characterized by juvenile behavior and that he objects to being invited to the indignity. Is some of the behavior juvenile? I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. Democracy is never genteel. People think that it's terrible in today's times, but there's lots of historical examples of this behavior, you know, going back to the founding.
Justice Samuel Alito, he once said that it's very hard because presidents will fake you out. So if the president says, "Isn't this the greatest country in the world?" And if you sit there looking like the proverbial potted plant, he said, "You look like you're very unpatriotic." So you get up and you start to clap, and then the president will say, "Because we are conducting a surge in Iraq," or "Because we're going to enact health care reform," and then you have to immediately stop clapping. It's very awkward. Do you have any sympathy for Alito?
Not really. First, that's a hypothetical that my colleague Todd Peppers, who did most of the reviewing of videotape, et cetera, didn't see a lot of examples of. Generally, the justices don't respond much to any of the comments. If you were watching the most recent State of the Union, they essentially sat and listened while people were rising on both sides around them.
Now, after Alito's reaction to the chiding of Obama a couple of years ago, he said he wasn't going to be attending, Scalia doesn't attend, and yet there's this assumption that justices do traditionally attend, and you found that's not the case.
Well, the first evidence we have that they were in attendance was the 1957 State of the Union Address. From that period forward, they intended in force. Up until 1980, there were at least 8 justices on average there. It has fallen off since 1980, and particularly in the early 2000s, Justice Breyer alone was in attendance at 3 of the addresses.
So why the fall off?
The things that we did find to have an effect might be what one would expect. That is that as justices get older, the probability of attendance decreases. On the other hand, many justices, like Brennan, were regular attenders despite advanced age and tenure. Justices tend to go to those addresses if the president is the one who appointed them. But beyond that, partisanship just did not predict attendance at the State of the Union addresses.
Michael, do you think they should attend?
Yes, I think they should attend. The court depends upon public support more than any other branch of government. Beginning with Madison in the Federalist Papers, the argument has been made, and I think reasonably so, that absent the power of the purse or the sword, the court's powers rest upon the support of the American public. This is a real opportunity for the court to be seen. They wear the robes that sets them apart. They don't rise to partisan one-liners to applaud. This is exactly the kind of image that declares the importance of the court, but also the distinctiveness of the court.
How do you think the justices did this year? I think they looked like a hedge, a row of boxwoods.
But I think if you were looking early on, the fact that you had the president greeting them, that Roberts appointed by George W., Kennedy appointed by a Republican president, greeting, smiling, as well as Ginsburg hugging the president, that suggests that while they can have policy dust-ups, that these are not personal conflicts. That was an important moment for people to see.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Michael W. Giles is a political science professor at Emory University and co-author with Todd C. Peppers of Potted Plants and Political Images, The Supreme Court and the State of the Union Address.
Coming up, to track or not to track? That is the question the Supreme Court essentially punted on.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Supreme Court decided a case called U.S. versus Jones, which may have raised more questions than it answered. In that case, the Washington, D.C. police affixed a GPS device to the car of suspected drug dealer Antoine Jones for 28 days and amassed enough evidence to earn him life in prison. The Supreme Court ruled that tracking Jones violated his Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizure. The case set a precedent that merely attaching a GPS device to a car with the intent to collect data constitutes a search. But the court explicitly did not rule on whether that type of search is categorically unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Confused? Aaron Kerr, law professor at George Washington University and blogger for the Volokh Conspiracy, says that by not deciding whether attaching a GPS device is unreasonable, the court left law enforcement with too little to work with.
We know one thing with certainty, that the government can't place a GPS device on a car with no reason to think that there's any criminal conduct afoot. And that applies to the federal government and it applies to the state government. What we just don't know is if the government needs to get a search warrant. We don't know if the government needs just probable cause without a warrant. We don't know how much the government needs to do before installing a GPS device, but we know that they can't just install it on anyone's car without any cause at all.
I'm interested, though, in the D.C. Circuit Court decision that led up to the Supreme Court case. The prosecution argued that the threshold of search doesn't necessarily happen the first moment a GPS is put on the car, that it has to be on there for a certain period of time before it rises to the level of search. Can you tell me about the mosaic theory?
The idea is, instead of looking at whether an individual act is unconstitutional, maybe you should look at whether acts over a period of time are sort of collectively unconstitutional. And that would allow the government to install a GPS device for a limited period of time and then maybe require a warrant when the GPS device has been used for more than a week or 2 weeks. We don't exactly know where the dividing line is. although the majority in the Supreme Court did not embrace this theory, a few justices wrote additional opinions in which they indicated they very well might be willing to accept it in a future case.
How in the world would any law enforcement agency be able to interpret when this threshold has been reached to constitute unreasonable search? And how in the world could a court itself determine when that threshold has been passed? It is so subjective.
The problem with the mosaic theory is nobody knows if 10 days of monitoring is too much or 20 days. The concurring opinion by Justice Alito in the Jones case said, we don't know exactly where the line is, but 30 days, which is the amount of monitoring in the Jones case, was too much. I tend to think if the Supreme Court in a future case has to grapple with this issue, they won't want to adopt this mosaic theory because of these difficult line drawing problems. But that's just a prediction, and we're going to have to wait and see.
Can those of us who worry about police intrusion take heart in the fact that the justices ruled that GPS is, in fact, a search?
If you're worried about privacy, if you're worried about how new technologies threaten privacy, this is a terrific decision. There's not a lot of clarity, but there are strong suggestions that the court would be willing to adopt new privacy protections that we have not yet seen before. And more generally, 9 justices of the Supreme Court are worried about privacy, just like a lot of Americans are.
And on the flip side, if you're worried about putting bad guys in jail using reasonable police tools for so doing, should you be alarmed?
The Supreme Court over U.S. history has tried to tailor the constitutional protections to new technologies. The Supreme Court justices tried to adjust the level of constitutional protection to try to restore the traditional balance of the Constitution. At least so far, we see the 9 justices very much engaged in the problem.
Now, as I understand it, it actually expands the definition of privacy under the 4th Amendment. Can you tell me more?
For the last 40 years or so, the Supreme Court has said that the Constitution only protects reasonable expectations of privacy. In the Jones case, the court said the Constitution does protect reasonable expectations of privacy, but it also protects against government conduct that was a trespass as of the time of the framing of the Constitution.
So 220 years ago, when GPS technology was at a very early stage, what constituted trespass?
There's some disagreement in the opinions in the Jones case as to what was trespass at the time. But the idea is touching somebody else's property with an intent to find something out by doing that. So what the court said was, when the GPS device was installed, that itself was not a constitutional search. But installing the GPS device with an intent to get information from the GPS device, that was a trespass.
So a cop putting a GPS tracker on your car is trespass, provided he does so with the intention of keeping track of you. But if he just does it as a decorative element, the court's down with that.
Strange but true. The court, in fact, comes out and says, if it's just installing the device without any intent to ever use it, that's okay. That's not a constitutional search.
Oren, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Oren Kerr is a professor of law at George Washington University and contributor to the blog The Volokh Conspiracy.
More than a year ago, we started to track the progress of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, legislation designed to strengthen protections for federal employees who expose waste, fraud, or abuse, and who are frequently punished or fired because they do. The act was killed by an 11th-hour secret hold placed, we later learned, by Senate Republicans at the behest of the House leadership. Well, that was then. Now another version of the bill has emerged yet again in Congress. And in June, Carolyn Lerner was appointed the new head of the United States Office of Special Counsel, an independent office tasked with protecting federal whistleblowers. It's a task the office has been pretty ineffective at in the past, but Lerner is getting high marks from whistleblower advocates. She says that part of her job is fighting the negative image of whistleblowers.
Senator Grassley is fond of saying that whistleblowers are often treated like a skunk at a picnic. There's a feeling that people who come forward are often just kind of complainers. Whistleblowers save the government money. They make our airplanes fly more safely. They keep our food safe. They protect our workforce and our country, we need whistleblowers, and it's important that people know about our agency.
Could you describe what the office is able to do on behalf of whistleblowers?
Well, we wear different hats. The first one is our disclosure unit. Any federal employee who wants to report waste, fraud, or abuse, or a health or safety issue, we then do a review and determine if there's enough evidence to warrant the agency doing an investigation. A little less than 10% of the cases, we then refer the case back to the agency for a full investigation. The second hat that we wear is the Investigation and Prosecution Division. When whistleblowers feel that they have been retaliated against, we have independent investigative authority to look at their claims and then, if necessary, prosecute them to the Merit Systems Protection Board.
What's the state of that board? They almost always find in favor of the agency. At least that's been the case for the last decade and a half. And as a result, whistleblowers don't feel they can get a fair shake.
There are three members of that board. And you're right that for many, many years, it was very difficult for an employee to prevail there. The board is now a little bit more open to employees, and that's made it a little bit easier for us to bring cases there.
It's possible that the new attitude of that once resolutely anti-whistleblower court could affect the future of a whistleblower we've had on the show, Franz Geil, who was a civilian advisor to the U.S. military, who first quietly and then increasingly noisily exposed the lack of mine-resistant vehicles in Iraq in 2006. Delays in ordering those vehicles were costing a lot of lives. When we spoke to him last, he was on administrative leave that looked to be permanent.
We were able to go to the MSPB and get a stay to stop his termination. During the stay, the Department of Defense reinstated his security clearance, so he was temporarily prevented from being terminated. And that's an example of how we're trying to be a little bit more proactive by taking cases like that to the MSPB.
A woman named DMT Lee seems to be the current poster child for whistleblowers. You've been addressing her case.
Yes. She was pressured by her supervisors at the Defense Contract Audit Agency to rush through audits, even when there was evidence of waste and other misconduct. Her disclosures led to congressional intervention and widespread reforms, which have the potential to save the government billions of dollars. Unfortunately, rather than being rewarded for her courage in speaking out, she was harassed, subject to a hostile work environment, unfair performance evaluations, and it looked like they were ready to terminate her. This is a very common practice when someone comes forward, but we were able to protect her job, and she's very happily employed now. And I don't think there's any question about the value that she provided to our government.
What would the passage of decent whistleblower protection legislation mean for your office?
There's a widespread belief that the current whistleblower protections are inadequate. We are really handcuffed. We can always weed out frivolous claims. But unfortunately, right now, we're also required to close out a number of very good claims. Under current law, employees are not protected for blowing the whistle in the course of their job duties. So that means employees can be fired for disclosing evidence of waste, fraud, or abuse if it was part of their job to do so.
Is what you're saying that if somebody finds waste, fraud, or abuse in the course of doing their job and they expose that, they'll be in trouble? But if they pass somebody else's office and see waste, fraud, and abuse and they report that, but it's not part of their own job, then they're protected?
That's exactly right. It doesn't make much sense, but that's where we are right now.
That's insane.
It happens with federal auditors, safety inspectors, whose job it is to unearth problems. If they expose them and are retaliated against for having done so, they are not protected.
Do you have any idea how we came to that pass?
It's certainly not in the law, but it has been interpreted by courts that way.
What's their justification?
This all goes back to how whistleblowers are perceived. I think that it is a very common perception that people who come forward and make complaints are troublemakers. Some of the time that may be the case. As I said, only less than 10% of the cases actually get referred for investigation. So I don't think there's a problem with our being able to screen out the false claims or the claims that don't have merit. But we do have a problem with how people are perceived who do come forward, and that has to change.
Carolyn, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Carolyn Lerner is head of the U.S. Office of Special Counsel. Tom Devine is legal director of the nonpartisan public advocacy group, the Government Accountability Project, where he's been working on passage of a Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act for more than a decade. He calls Lerner's appointment to the once moribund Office of Special Counsel a breath of fresh air.
It's like waking up from a long nightmare and all of a sudden the sun is shining and the sky is blue, and I'm sure the honeymoon will be over at some point, but right now we're just having a hard time finding anything to criticize.
But no matter how well-intentioned she may be, she has a lot of limitations in that office, right?
The primary limitation is she doesn't have a decent law to work with. And until that changes, we can have the most dedicated presidential appointments that anyone would dream of. They're not going to have the tools to deliver.
Which brings us to Franz Geil. Carolyn Lerner got him his job back, but pick it up from there.
His first day back, he was demoted and stripped of all of his science and technology duties. In other words, the reaction of the Marines to this scientist who had stopped unnecessary casualties in Iraq was, never again. You made us look bad. No one in the Marines has anything to lose by harassing this public servant. The worst that'll happen is they won't get away with it. And that's one of the cornerstones of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, arming the special counsel with the authority to seek discipline, get bureaucrats fired who harass whistleblowers instead of just blocking them.
Last year, we worked with you on a project to sniff out who put the secret hold on the Whistleblower Protection Act, which effectively killed it. That act has now been reintroduced. Where does it stand?
We passed both the Senate and House committees unanimously last fall, but some of the key committee chairs in the House are gutting some of the major provisions. For example, the House Judiciary Committee cut out jury trials for federal workers. That's just inexcusable. We've passed jury trial rights for corporate whistleblowers for nearly the entire private sector. And there's really no excuse to say that government workers who are defending the taxpayers deserve second-class whistleblower rights compared to corporate workers who are defending the shareholders. But that's what's happened so far in the House. And then there's the national security loophole. The head of the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence has said that if there's any protections for people in the intelligence community, they'll block the bill from being voted on. This is the largest source of fraud, waste, and abuse in the government, the national security bureaucracy, because it is so secret, they don't have anything more than an honor system to keep their actions in check.
Tom, they must have a reason.
I think there's a very good reason. The revolving door between the staff of the House Intelligence Committee and the intelligence bureaucracy, it's free-flowing. The House right now is bogged down behind closed doors in demands from one committee to the next. They've said there won't be a bill if the government workers get jury trials. There won't be a whistleblower law if the intelligence community employees have any rights to challenge fraud, waste, and abuse within their agencies. There won't be any law if people like Franz Geil can challenge retaliatory yanking of their security clearances. And there's no public record about this. There's no public discussion or debate. There's no defense.
If we wanted a comment, someone to respond to your accusations, whose office should we call?
The buck has to stop at the top and get in touch with Speaker Boehner and Mr. Cantor and ask them if they're going to support rights so that people who defend the taxpayers can defend themselves. Fighting government misspending may accomplish as much or more as any of these showdowns to shut down the government or bankrupt the Treasury. How about a real commitment to get the job done?
Carolyn Lerner says the whistleblower has a PR problem. Do you think that's part of what's keeping this bill from moving?
I think whistleblowers have a public relations problem with the power structure. They certainly don't with the public. The National Taxpayers Union has made this their highest legislative priority to pass the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. The surveys that preceded all of the votes of the laws to protect corporate whistleblowers showed that swing voters find the priority of protecting whistleblowers higher than any other public policy issue except to stop illegal government spending. And Congress responded, almost riding a political wave to help whistleblowers in the private sector. Then the same people who supported the legislation with a record vote put secret holds on it. We don't have any problem with the public not having solidarity for whistleblowers. It's these politicians who are in bed with the bureaucrats.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thanks for hearing me out.
Tom Devine is the legal director of the Government Accountability Project.
Coming up, is access to the internet a human right?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to reform the voting process for military and overseas citizens at PewTrust.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at WallaceFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Don't mess with the internet. That was the message to Congress last week when public outrage forced it to table some Hollywood-backed bills that would have attacked online piracy by barring access to suspected sites. But Hollywood's influence extends well beyond Capitol Hill. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has created a website called Global Choke Points, which tracks pending or existing legislation that would kick people or websites off the internet all around the world. Take, for example, Spain's Ley Sinde, a law enacted earlier this month which adopted some of the most controversial parts of the American SOPA legislation shelved last week. According to diplomatic cables exposed by WikiLeaks, the U.S. put intense pressure on Spain to adopt tougher copyright laws. The cables specifically cite the influence on the U.S. ambassador to Spain by the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. The Electronic Frontier Foundation's Rainey Reitman says this did not sit well with the Spanish public.
There was a huge outcry in Spain. They felt that American powers were trying to force legislation that Spain didn't want onto the Spanish people, and they actually defeated the law. The government changed in Spain, and within 10 days, we did see the new government decide to enact this legislation. So now, for the first time, we are seeing Ley Sinde as an active piece of legislation in Spain.
Now, the allegation is, and what the WikiLeaks leaks seem to corroborate, is that the embassy and the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative strong-armed the government into accepting Ley Sinde. But with what as leverage? What was the quid pro quo?
So every year, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representatives puts out this special 301 report. This is a statement towards American businesses about whether or not they should be investing in those countries. And the letter was leaked to the Spanish newspaper El País, showing that the U.S. ambassador had put additional pressure on the Spanish government, threatening not just to put this on this 301 watch list, but on the even more scary priority watch list, which only about a dozen countries in the world are put on. In the letter, the U.S. ambassador said that he felt that the decision not to enact the Ley Sinde law would have a detrimental effect on the reputation and economy of Spain.
The countries that you are listing on Global Choke Points are actually not limited to Europe. There's also South Korea and New Zealand, and various kinds of laws that you say restrict internet freedom. What are the various ways that these laws work?
In France, they have what's called the double pane. So France has a law called Hadopi that came around in October of 2009. And when individuals there are accused on the third time of violating intellectual property laws, they won't only have their internet shut down, but also have to continue to pay for it.
Now, New Zealand is also another kind of three strikes deal, but what was interesting is the way it was tacked on to another piece of legislation that had to pass because it was so timely.
It was tacked on to an Earthquake Victims Relief Act back in April of 2011. But basically, it is the same process where people who are accused of repeated infringement of intellectual property law will be disconnected from the internet for up to 6 months and could get substantial fines as well.
How about South Korea?
They had 11 users cut off in 2010, and in 2011, they cut off 17. How long these individuals will be shut off from the internet is not clear in the legislation itself.
Tell me about the bizarro world circumstances in Ireland.
Unlike these other countries, Ireland didn't have a law put into place. Instead, what they have is a backroom deal that was negotiated between the Irish Recorded Music Association and Aircom, which is the largest ISP in Ireland. These two groups were involved in a lawsuit, and rather than finish the lawsuit, they settled out of court. And in May 2010, Aircom decided to adopt what they're calling a voluntary three strikes policy. That means there's no judge involved, no jury. Individuals who have internet service through Aircom will receive three warnings, and on the fourth warning, they could have their internet cut off for up to 1 year. Again, no judge, no jury.
So if you're a consumer, what can you do?
We're seeing, by some estimates, up to 1,000 a month subscribers leaving Aircom to go to alternative ISPs. However, we know for a fact that the Irish Recorded Music Association is engaged in 8 other lawsuits against ISPs in Ireland, perhaps trying to reach the same settlement agreement that they got with Aircom. And one could imagine a situation where there were no additional options for users who wanted to go elsewhere, and there'd be no law in place, and thus no law that they could possibly have overturned.
Rainey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rainey Reitman is the activism director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Signed that day and ratified in law, zipped our mouths up and took away our appetite for more. I can't do much now about the way it is, but if I could go back and change things, I'd say this. Truth is beauty, at least it used to be, and if you disagree with my views, then you can sue me. In the meantime, I'll keep using YouTube, even if it means that I need to find a new media. IRC, darknet, so digital's down now, I'll use pigeons and smoke signals.
We all cry foul when access to the web is threatened or cut off altogether, as it was in Egypt during the protests there exactly 1 year ago. Last summer, a United Nations report declared that the internet had become, quote, an indispensable tool for realizing a range of human rights. Some countries have gone as far as calling access to the internet itself a human right. Not so fast, says Vinton Cerf, one of the true founders of the internet. In a recent New York Times op-ed, he argues that while the internet is a terrific tool for improving the human condition, it does not rise to the level of a human right.
Today, if someone said, well, you still have a human right to access to a horse, and my reaction would be, well, I don't know where I'd put it. And second, I have 250 horses sitting in my garage right now, which is the replacement for the barn, and I don't need the other one. So my only concern here is not to get so tangled up in a particular technology that we lose sight of the intent, which is to assure the human right to communicate. Believe me, I am the last person in the world to argue that internet is not useful. It is incredibly useful. It is incredibly powerful.
I understand that, Reverend Cerf. So
Is evangelist really in your job title? I see it everywhere.
It really is. When they asked me what title I wanted, I said, how about Archduke? And they said, well, that didn't quite fit. So how about being our chief internet evangelist? And that seemed to work okay.
You wrote that however well-meaning the argument is for declaring internet access a right, that the status demands a higher bar, and that if we lower it, we could end up valuing the wrong things. Like what? What's the real danger here?
If you look in the Constitution, if you look at the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, you find that these rights are often associated with things like the right to speak, the right to hear, the right to assemble, the right to food and shelter and clothing. These are very fundamental, and they are, I would say, almost immutable. Whereas the technologies that enable them are going to change over time. And so my alarm here was that binding a particular technology to human rights seems like it has the potential mistake that after you've done this and the technology changes, then you have to say, oh, well, we didn't really mean that. This new technology is our new human right.
But why can't that right transfer from technology to technology?
If you were to take the view that the internet is a human right or access to the internet is a human right, the implication of that is that everyone in the world should be given access, that it has to be provided by the society. And here we run into a problem. We might have as a goal that everyone should have access, and we might even take the view that you can't be denied access when it's available. The problem is requiring it to be available, and I think that's where I have a problem.
If we agree for the purposes of this conversation that internet access does not rise to the level of a human right, do you think it rises to the level of a civil right? Or can you find some analogy in American history to address that?
The 1934 Telecommunications Act, which, by the way, also included the accessibility to electrical power, comes very close because those two utilities were thought to be sufficiently important that it should be government policy to make it feasible for anyone to have reasonable expectation of access to them. And one could imagine that the present-day broadband initiatives in the United States and in other countries like Australia rise to the level of a civil right conferred by intent by the government.
The bedrock of your argument, whether we're talking about horses or phones, is that internet access is always a tool for obtaining something else that's more important.
I think that it's very important not to mix up the tool with the outcome. The outcome is the ability to communicate, to speak, to hear, to gain access to information. But there might someday be other technologies that enable these outcomes even more effectively, and we'd want to adopt those as alternatives.
You conclude your op-ed by asserting that the most fundamental issue here is the responsibility of the technology creators themselves to support human and civil rights. Google, along with Yahoo and Microsoft, has in the past censored search results when asked to do it by the Chinese government. I know Google has since changed its policy on this. Cisco and others have sold tools to repressive regimes that enable them to target oppressed groups, like the Chinese can target the Falun Gong. This would be a failure to ensure that the internet remains a means to a better life, wouldn't it?
I think it is a more nuanced question than that. This is a two-edged sword. The things that we might do in the internet to protect people from abuse might also be used by others to inhibit speech. And it would be healthy, I think, for engineers like me and others to be reminded that these technologies are important tools in the context of exercising civil rights or even human rights, and that we should be alert to things that we can do to assure that they can continue to be used that way.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Sure, no problem.
Vinton Cerf is a fellow at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers and a vice president and chief internet evangelist for Google. Jonathan Zittrain is a professor at the Harvard Law School and co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So do you think that access to the internet is a human right?
To put it in terms of Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression, and it includes the freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. That sure sounds a lot like the internet, but it doesn't make it medium specific. So if in 25 years we're all using the contranet, we don't have to go back and revise our universal declarations.
Vinton Cerf argues that it's short-sighted to label any particular technology a human right. It's just a tool for realizing our human rights. Can the technologies that ensure those rights be separated from the rights themselves?
Well, there's always a tension between articulating rights at a high enough level of abstraction that they have an enduring quality, but also having it be specific enough that these lofty ideals can't just be dismissed as inapplicable to a particular situation. There's a phenomenon we might call status quoism. In 1985, you were getting your news from television, you were getting your books from a library, you were getting your newspaper from your local hometown city. You'd have to go to great lengths just to see the newspaper from Chicago if you happened to live in Washington. And it's not as if at that time somehow people's rights were being violated or they were unfree. But once the internet comes along and changes that baseline, you wouldn't want somebody to say, well, if I prevent you, if you're in Washington, from seeing something in Chicago, hey, it's only just putting you back to where you were in 1985 and you were fine then. That's using a baseline to limit speech. And in that sense, the internet has been singularly transformative in giving people an ability to speak, to listen, and to associate that blows 1985 out of the water. And I would love to see our understanding of the First Amendment and Article 19 bolt that progress down. And in that sense, that's why it might be sensible to talk about the internet as today's technology as something to which we have a right. But we can do that without having to change any particular lofty declarations. Those are written at a higher level.
One thing that Vin Cerf was concerned about wasn't that people would be denied access, but somehow governments who signed on to this might feel that they had to provide it, which in many places is very expensive.
It certainly is. Generally, around the world, when rights are declared, usually those rights are thought of as so-called negative rights. They're rights against government intrusion, rather than affirmative rights where the government is expected to give them something they don't already have, including such things as food, shelter, and education. So for a right to internet, at least, it might be worth saying it's an aspiration. It would be good government policy to make sure people have access, meaningful access to the internet. But whether or not that means the person could run into court and say, I want broadband, you know, here's my address, I await your cable truck, that's a different story.
Do you think it would even matter if the internet were classified as a human right? I mean, the world's record defending human rights has been less than stellar.
But it does matter to have people able to talk about internet policy with the guiding light of principles like Article 19 and the First Amendment. And I don't sense any great groundswell of effort to add internet to these documents because there's no need to. There is a need, however, to be mindful of these high abstractions, to be able to work them into day-to-day debates, and to even recognize the observation coined these days as Metcalfe's Law, that the value of a network doubles with every additional node to it.
Every individual participant.
Yes, and because that one node can communicate with everybody on the network, it doubles the number of potential links. Recognizing that and embodying that in policy, I think is a really good thing. It's at the end of the day, really, a statement about humanity, not about computers.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Zittrain is a professor at the Harvard Law School and co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Boats, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. You can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.